So welcome to the Gabriel Huber Show. In this episode, we delve into the extraordinary world of aviation leadership with Rene Bangalsorf. As a founder and CEO of the Aviation Collective, Rene is at the forefront of equipping aviation leaders with transformative tools to revitalize their organizations and shape the industry's future. Join us as we explore Rene's remarkable journey from brokering over $1 billion in global aircraft sales as the founder and CEO of the Charlie Bravo Aviation to a pivotal role in the Federal Aviation Administration's Women in Aviation Advisory Board, where she addresses the critical challenges and opportunities facing the aviation workforce. Thank you so much for joining me.
Ah, thanks so much for having me. I appreciate it.
So my first question to you was, you're in an industry that is extremely heavily dominated by males, and you still managed to be so successful. How did you manage that?
Well, there are a couple of things. One, it's rather easy to stand out as a tall redhead in an industry that has mostly men. So there are pros and cons to that, right? People remember me, but also lots of eyes are on me. So I think one of the reasons that I probably found some success is that I found people who wanted to help me succeed, which is really important. But then also I probably applied a lot of pressure to myself to succeed so that I didn't allow the women who, other women in the industry to be embarrassed about my performance. So I worked really hard to get where I was, some from eyes on me and some from internal pressure.
And when did you start your journey in the aviation business?
Probably in 2002. I moved to Texas with my then husband, and we were both working for a company that did aircraft brokerage. And then in 2008, we started our own company called Charlie Bravo Aviation, and I was the CEO of that company until 2021. And so during my tenure as CEO there, for that 13 years, we did almost $1 billion in worldwide private aircraft sales. So mostly private jets, but some turboprops and helicopters. And we did sales on 44 different countries, on six continents in 44 different countries. So very much an international business. And I enjoyed that it was different every day.
And that was so fascinating to me because I just can't imagine how you sell a private jet. You know, I mean, what is it? Is it like a sales pitch, or what people do you address to even sell private jets to?
You know, it's really a relationship sale. And so it starts with building a relationship first with airplane owners. And so, you know, talking with aircraft owners, letting them know the valuation, the current valuation of their aircraft, the current market for their aircraft, and then gaining trust. And then when they decide to upgrade their aircraft or get rid of their aircraft, then they've built a relationship with you. And those relationships take time. I mean, I've had a sales cycle as short as 3 or 4 weeks, and I've experienced sales cycles that are 10 or 12 years of building trust and developing a relationship in order to gain the sale.
And when you're selling this, what do the buyers look for in an airplane? Like, what questions would they ask you?
Oh my goodness, hundreds of questions. The questions that I ask them starting out are really about why they're wanting to purchase an aircraft, what their mission is, and what their budget is. And then from those answers, I'm able to really extrapolate what's most important to them and help them determine what aircraft will fit their needs. And sometimes the answer is that owning an aircraft isn't going to be a good fit for them. And I've told a number of people that, hey, it seems like the idea of having a plane is a really good one for you, but maybe actually owning the aircraft isn't a good financial decision for you. You're not going to fly it enough. You wouldn't really use it. You don't perhaps have the budget for the operating expenses ongoing, and it's going to end up being frustrating for you. And so I think that, I lose a sale that way, but it gives me an internal integrity that I feel really good about. And then when I can relay that to new buyers, they believe that I have their best interest in mind. And that's a great way to build trust.
And what are the main reasons people buy jets?
There are a few reasons. In the United States, there are some tax write-off reasons, and that's been a little bit different for the last 5 or 6 years, in that we've had the ability to write off the entire purchase price in the first year. That's going away now, but that's one reason. Another reason is for privacy, right? If you're a celebrity and you have, you get accosted at the airport, or if you're a business person and you need to have private business conversations on an airplane and not have people listening in, privacy is a big aspect. Another one is convenience, to be able to go from here to there at the exact time you need to be there and come back in the same day is really important. This is probably is going to sound unusual because of the price of their goods, but Walmart has a very large private aircraft fleet, and they actually sent people out from Bentonville, Arkansas, which is not near a big airport, in the morning to go look at new facilities, to meet with buyers, and they bring them back the same day. So all of the executives and buyers for Walmart, by and large, use private aviation to be there and back in the same day. And that, according to Sam Walton's biography, cuts down on expenses for overnight stays. It cuts down on extramarital affairs within his company. And it gives people a focus on getting there, getting the job done, and getting back. So it changes the efficiency culture in the organization.
And from what point on does it even make sense to own one? Because I mean, I would imagine you have to fly a certain number of hours or a certain number of trips that it even makes sense to get a jet. Do you have a number in mind for that or?
I do, and it largely depends on what you're doing outside of owning a private jet. So if you charter a plane, so you're flying private already, then yes, it makes sense to buy a private airplane once you get to about 200 or 250 hours a year that you're flying private. That's, 2 or 3 trips a month. You can also offset some of your fixed costs. Obviously, you're still going to have direct operating costs, but the fixed cost by chartering out or allowing your airplane to be chartered. And so that'll cut down some of your fixed costs, the hangar, the pilots, the insurance, the overall maintenance, the wear and tear on the plane. So you can offset some of that. But you should plan, even if you buy an airplane that's only $1 or $2 million, you should really be calculating $750,000 to $4 or $5 million in operating expenses a year.
And what type of people would you sell to, and what kind of planes could you sell? You just bought them and then you would resell them, or you.
Sure. Yeah. We help people with buying them and reselling them. Typically, we'll work with a client over their lifetime on 5 or 6 different transactions. And we work with a lot of private individuals, small business owners, small to medium-sized business owners. We've worked with large corporations. We've worked with nonprofits like Red Cross. We've worked with defense organizations like Lockheed Martin. We've worked with foreign governments. We've worked with all sorts of different people over the years who buy for various reasons. There's a lot of charitable work that's done on airplanes, a lot of relief work. And we helped someone buy an aircraft who uses it to transport goods in and out of war zones to provide relief supplies to refugees.
And I mean, I can only imagine running a company like that. How many employees did you have?
Well, I no longer own Charlie Bravo
Yeah,
Aviation, so
exactly.
recently divorced and have no further interest in the company, so I can't speak to their number of employees now, but we ranged from 4 to 12 when I was
Okay.
active as the CEO.
And how did you pick, or how do you still now pick the right people to work with for your team?
Ah, this gets to the heart of the conversation that you and I wanted to have, and that's about what it's like to own your own business, I think. So I'm going to address it from that standpoint because I actually do a lot of coaching in this area now. I've been a professional business coach, first as a side hustle and now as my main occupation for the last 5 years. And one of the things that I always recommend when people are hiring new employees is to do values-based hiring. You can teach skills. You can't change someone's values. And so that's at the heart of almost all of the employee terminations that I've recommended to my coaching clients over the years. It's at the heart of almost all of the toxic relationships within a workplace is a values misalignment. So making sure that you get really clear as a business owner or as a manager on your personal values, what you don't compromise on, what's most important to you. And then you get clear on what those values are for your company. And there'll be some alignment. There'll be a little bit of difference, but there'll be some major alignment there. And then you hire people who have the same values. If you value honesty or integrity and you hire someone who's doesn't have that as a value and they're all about making the most money they possibly can, which can be that can look great for you toward your bottom line, but then you find that they've cut corners or they've been a little bit unethical about something or they've been dishonest with a client and you're constantly going behind them, cleaning up messes or making excuses or resolving issues with that person, you made a bad hire. So my first recommendation is always hire for values and fire for values.
And how do you find those people? Do you just, I mean, I guess you probably just get not normal job interviews as well, but what do you ask in the job interview to figure out those values?
Yeah, in a job interview, I'll usually talk pretty strongly about values. I'll say, hey, these are the values of our company. And sometimes I'll even give the hint ahead of time, like, hey, I'd love for you to familiarize yourself with our company. And if that values page is on the company website, that should be one of the things that they're looking at. And then in the interview, I'll say, hey, of these seven values that are core values of our company, which one do you relate to the most? Which one is most important to you? And then I'll ask the question, Gabriel, excellence is one of my company values. You say that that is one of your core values as well. Tell me an instance in your previous employment where you had a conflict with someone that excellence was the reason for the conflict. And how did you resolve that?
Oh, that's very interesting. Yeah.
And when you ask that question, I am one testing you to see if excellence really is your value or if you're just telling me that. If you've had to defend that value before, and then I get a ton of insight about your ability to have conflict resolution and how strongly you feel about that value in your answers to that question. And so it's not like, why is excellence important to you? Because of course you could tell me that. But how have you put that importance into action is something really good. And I think it tells you a lot about a person's character and their conflict resolution and their ability to work with others when you start diving into things like values.
And I guess for you, that also ensures that they're a good long-term fit, because if they have good values, they will, even if they make a few mistakes, they will still stick to those values and still recover from the mistakes they've made, maybe.
Absolutely. If I hire an employee and they don't make mistakes, then I'm very worried about that because that means that they're not stretching and growing and taking risks and putting things on the line for my company. And that's in conflict with another one of my values, which is growth, right? So I think that we have to make mistakes in order to grow. And I think age has given me that perspective, right? Failing is not a terrible thing. It means that you're learning hard lessons. And if you don't fail at things, then you're not stretching, you're not growing, you're not risking, and you're not learning the things that build stronger character and more innovative workplace.
And now, once you've gotten the right people in the company, how do you organize your companies or the businesses you're working at the moment to ensure that everybody's on the same page and that the company's running well?
A lot of that is rhythms, so cadences and rhythms. But it really starts from some hard work on setting a vision for the company and setting a mission for the company. And to me, a mission is really about identifying what kind of company you are, who you serve, so who's your avatar. What transformation you help them accomplish, and how you do that. So, if I'm thinking about a company that I'm working with right now, it's a technology company that helps travelers who want to experience private flight find empty leg flights at a discounted price. And so that tells you, like, I'm looking for people who are willing to spend some money on flights, who are interested in flying private, even if that isn't their normal mode of transportation. And they really just need a way to find those flights. And so once I get that mission there, then I look at the vision of being able to connect operators who have empty leg flights with people who are interested in flying on those. And that becomes my company vision. So then I align the tasks that I have each team member doing toward that vision at the top, because I've set goals coming down for each person to accomplish that vision and to fulfill that mission. And so then it comes down to cadences of here's what's expected of you. Here's how we're going to measure your success. What do you need in order to make the tasks that you have or the goals that you have achievable or manageable? Are there tools that you need? Is there communication that you need? How do you manage setbacks? And with tech companies, there are always setbacks. How do we manage the chaos of this tech company to keep going toward the same goal? So that's managing people going off on tangents or rabbit trails on meetings. It's managing expectations. It's resetting boundaries or deadlines for things. And it's doing that in a cadence. So a monthly meeting for some team members, a weekly meeting for some team members, a daily stand-up for other team members in the cadence that makes sense to accomplish the overall goals.
And you quickly mentioned that you also try to measure your team's success. How do you measure it? Do you just use statistics, or how do you measure your team's success?
Yeah, so a couple of different ways. So some of it is tangible and some's intangible, right? So when I set goals, I set goals that are measurable. And so if we're going to have an app live or functioning in this way by the end of March, we set milestones in place. Like, hey, here's the roadmap to get there. Here are the milestones that we need to set in place. Here are the deadlines for those. And then we measure against those. Like, how close are you to that? Are you 90%? Did you finish it last week? Where's the additional 10%? So asking the hard questions. And then the other thing that I do is I talk about leadership growth, and leadership always starts with yourself. So if you're my employee, I'm going to be asking you, what are you doing to grow in your leadership right now? What books are you reading? What conflicts are you managing? What are the things that are holding you back from being the best version of you and getting to the bottom of some of that? Because sometimes there's a mindset that's causing you not to be able to accomplish the key performance indicators or KPIs that we set together. And sometimes it's really that doesn't align with your personality. So some of it is, a person, a really great person in a wrong seat that needs to be adjusted. And you don't really get to the bottom of that looking at how they're stacking up against their KPIs. You get to the bottom of that by having great conversations with them about that. For instance, I'm really good at negotiating. I am absolutely horrible at prospecting for sales. So I know that I can close a sale over and over and over again. And I've had clients tell me in aircraft sales, I've never worked with a broker who could overcome as many obstacles in closing a deal as you. You're really good at it. But I know that I am terrible at picking up the phone and making calls to get prospects in our pipeline. So I had to learn that instead of beating myself up about prospecting, I hired prospectors. And then once they had a deal at the table, then I took the piece of it that was in my wheelhouse, and together we were successful. So sometimes it's rearranging pieces and taking things that are a drain on someone's energy off of their plate and finding someone whose plate they fit better on, and then using that person for the things at which they're brilliant.
And what is your personal decision process like? Let's say you have a tough decision in front of you. Are there things you rely on when making decisions? Is it just experience or is it intuition? What do you rely on?
Gosh, you have lots of deep questions today. Personally, I have a life vision. And that life vision is about, it started out with, do I have a life plan? And I'm like, psh, who can come up with a plan in today's world? Like, oh, I want to publish 5 books and I want to be a CEO of a Fortune 500 company. But like, life sends you lots of curveballs. And so I never jived with the thought of having a life plan, but having a life vision means that I know, and this sounds a little bit morbid, but I'm in my 50s. So I have to think like this sometimes, what I want my kids to be able to say about me at my funeral. And I want to be intentional about the person that I am. And so I have a life vision that outlines, hey, this is what I want to be true about my life today. This is what I want to be true about my life when I'm 70. This is what I want to be true about my life when I'm at the very end of my life. And so I filter my decisions first through my life vision. And then secondly, I filter it through something that I call a double win dream list. So every year, about this time, I look at what I want to be true across a number of domains in my life in 3 years. So if you and I are having this conversation at the very beginning of 2027, I want these things to be true about my life. One of those things is that I want to have my instrument rating for my airplane license, right? I want to be able to fly in the clouds. I want to be able to fly above the clouds, metaphorically and literally. And so what are the things that are going to help me achieve that? And what are the things that are going to compromise that? And sometimes I'll say no to something that seems really good, because it means that I'm going to be able to say yes to something that aligns with where I want to be in 3 years or in 20 years.
Okay. And I also read you, what kind of pilot's license do you have at the moment?
So right now I have my private pilot's license. So that means that I can fly a single engine plane and land on land. Like I can't land on water. I'm not licensed to do that yet, but I can land my little four-seater airplane pretty much anywhere in the United States.
Well, that's cool because I also want to get a pilot's license at some point. How many hours is that?
It depends. So I don't know what, I think you're in Germany. I don't know what the EASA requirements are for that. Lots of people actually come to the United States to get their pilot's license, and it takes anywhere from 40 to 80 hours of flying to get your license. It normally takes about 6 to 9 months. Or you can do it like I did it. So I decided that a couple of years ago that I was going to have an immersive experience. And I went out to California, found a dedicated airplane and a dedicated instructor, and did about 12 hours of flying and ground instruction a day and had my license in less than 4 weeks. So absolutely the most stretching my brain has had in a very long time. It was very challenging, but incredibly rewarding.
Yeah. And back to the life vision. Do you have any mentors yourself or any people you look up to?
I have a lot of mentors. I think that mentoring is very important. When I was first starting out in my career, I had a little bit more formal mentorship because I had a lot to learn. Now, what I find is very, very helpful is peer-to-peer mentorship. So a lot of times I'm in a friendship or business relationship with someone who can teach me something, and I have something that I can teach them. Case in point, I worked with one of the people that I consider a peer-to-peer mentor is my friend Bobby Wells. And Bobby is in charge of safety for American Airlines. And one of the things that Bobby likes about me is that I'm an entrepreneur and I think very different than she does. And one of the things that I love about Bobby is that she's very corporate and she thinks very differently than I do. So obviously with safety in one of the largest airlines in the world, she is very skilled in looking at systems and looking at an overall safety picture. And she's very good at navigating bureaucracy because she does a lot of work with the federal government in making sure that, that the airways and the airlines are safe. What I'm good at that she hasn't had the chance to develop as much is innovation and thinking outside of the box and solving problems quickly and getting around some of the red tape to make sure that things happen and looking at things in a more holistic way. So Bobby and I have worked together on a couple of different boards, and we've always found that balance to be very good. And I think she looks up to me in some ways and I look up to her in some ways. So that's an instance of peer-to-peer mentoring. I think that works well with young people who have different skills, but it also works as you develop and get older. The other thing that I think is really important is to have a coach. And a coach is different than a mentor in that a coach holds you accountable to things. So if you set a goal, and you meet with your coach every other week, your coach is going to ask you about that goal. Your coach is going to challenge you in areas that you haven't really thought of before and make you a better person, very much like a strength and conditioning coach would help you get stronger or perform better in your athletic endeavors.
And I know you've also written two books or co-written two books. I think you have one book that's completely your own, or I mean the stand up, how to flourish when the odds are stacked against you. That's completely your book.
It is my book. I actually wrote the other book as well. Crushing Mediocrity. I was the actual author of it. My
Okay.
friend, Lisa Copeland, who was in the automotive industry at the time, was a content contributor. And she
Okay.
and I, perhaps over one or two bottles of champagne one night, decided that women who flourish in male-dominated industries or who rise above the status quo in male-dominated industries have some things in common. And we decided that we were going to author a book about that. So we did lots of late night conversations about these things. We talked to a lot of other women and were able to pull together a fun book with some great examples in there.
And is there any return on investment on writing a book? Because I mean, if let's say some a company owner is listening right now, is there any value for them to writing a book?
I think there are a couple of things. So I think that the return on investment is one of the returns on investment is internal, right? When you put a pen to paper, or you really have to get clear about your thoughts in order to communicate them in a form that makes sense to other people, you develop clarity for yourself and you get more clear about where you're going and the kind of person that you want to be. So that's one thing. The other thing with a book is that it's really an expensive calling card, right? It's something that you can say, hey, here's who I am. Here's if you want to get to know me, if you want to know more about what makes me operate, read Stand Up. Like that's my journey. That's how I've gotten to the place that I've gotten to. And you would understand what my values are and how I've come to those values by reading that book. So it's a great introduction and an expensive calling card. It also gives some credibility to the person who wrote the book, and it invites deeper conversations. Some of those are from stage, some of those are in workshops. And then it's a great accomplishment, right? It's something that your kids and your family can see about you, even when you're gone.
And now, just because I see we're coming to the end here of the podcast, what is your life vision then currently for the future, for the next 10, 20, 30 years?
My life vision, is that I would serve God to the best of my abilities across all life domains as long as possible. Even if it feels hard or seems risky, that I reserve my best time and resources for things that matter eternally, my legacy, that I am always growing in strength, wisdom, grace, and truth, and that I guard my heart, my health, and my family. That's my life vision.
Well, I really appreciate you for coming out today.
Absolutely.
Are there any last things you maybe, especially to young people, want to give with when they're just starting their careers now?
Yes. It's hard work. It's hard work. And building a business, creating the life that you want is hard. It's not easy. It's not going to fall in your lap. The things that fall in your lap aren't that worthwhile. The things that you go after and you lose blood, sweat, and tears over, those are the things that are worthwhile. The late nights, the agony of wrestling through hard decisions, those are the things that build your character, that help you persevere when the times get tough. And if you can stick to something long enough, if you can be consistent, if you can get through the hard days just one day at a time, just one foot in front of the other, the payoff is great at the end. And if you aren't willing to do that, what you'll find is that you're just holding a vapor. So work hard. There are lots of people in your generation that aren't willing to work hard. So if you are willing to work hard, you stand out in an exceptional way, the same way that I stand out as a woman in a very male-dominated industry. So if you work harder than the people around you, you're gonna have an amazing life.
Well, thank you very much. I
You're
really
welcome.
appreciate it. What are you up to today then?
Today, I have some banking endeavors. I have a lot of business to set up for the next year. And then I am going to eat dinner with my three grandchildren. They're 1, 3, and 5. So lots of fun and excitement there.
So they're still here just for the holidays or just for this time now?
No, I live nearby them, about 15 minutes away.
Okay. And do you have any speaking things this year? Any speaking events or?
I do have a few. I'm working on setting up a few more. So some local things that I'm working on. And then if people want to follow me on social media, I post on that. My speaking events always are promoted on LinkedIn. So you can follow me at Renee Bengelsdorf on LinkedIn. And then my personal, I post more personal stuff on Facebook and Instagram, at Renee Bengelsdorf on both of those.
Yeah, sure. Because I mean, I'm in the States usually once a year because we're family in Chicago. Chicago and South Carolina. So maybe you just send me when you're at an event or something, then maybe it'll be nice to see you in person at some point.
Very good. I'd love that. You can go on my website, theaviationcollective.com, and sign up for my newsletter.
Okay.
And then you'll get all the alerts about my speaking events.
Okay, cool. Well, I don't
awesome.
Want to
Thanks.
I don't want to keep you any longer, but it was really nice talking to you.
You as well. Thanks, Gabriel.
Bye-bye. Have a nice day.